Hello, I'm Father Steve Spahn, and this is Provoke. It all began when our producer, Claire Hartman, pondered the question.
I wonder what a saint looks like in today's world. Would I even recognize one without the benefit of hindsight or a mandatory miracle or two? A really good photo ID wouldn't hurt either.
She remembered reading about Sister Dorothy Stang, a soft-spoken but exasperatingly headstrong American nun who traveled to Brazil as a missionary back in the 1960s, and faithfully served there for nearly 40 years. It seemed like a good place to start.
It did, but not because Dorothy was a nun and not because she was a missionary, although she was very good at both. No, it seemed like a good place to start because I knew how it ended. You see, Dorothy was murdered in 2005, gunned down by two hired assassins. She had a price on her head and she knew it, but she persevered anyway. Where did that courage come from? Who and what did she believe in? What kept her going? Was greatness thrust upon her, or had her whole life led up to that moment? These are the kind of things I wanted to know.
And so, with those questions in mind, Claire set off to discover just what made Dorothy tick. Along the way, she interviewed those who knew Dorothy best, her fellow nuns who lived and worked alongside her in Brazil, and who surely share in her greatness. We bring you now part three of our story, Modern Day Saints and Martyrs.
It wasn't just her steel magnolia yin and yang personality that enabled Dorothy to do what she did. The fact that she was a study in perpetual motion, yet found her greatest joy in the stillness of the forest. That she never raised her voice, but never gave up a fight either. It wasn't just that she was born at the right time, when the passion for social justice burning inside her was championed by an awakening church. It wasn't just the choices she made, to become a missionary instead of a school teacher, to serve the poor in Brazil instead of the U.S., or to follow the people deeper into the Amazon rather than settle closer to civilization and safety. It wasn't even her decision to become a Brazilian citizen that empowered her to do the things she did. Oh, to be sure, personality and timing and personal choice all played a role, but there were other factors. Perhaps none was more important than the support she received from her fellow sisters. Before she was a missionary, long before she became a Brazilian citizen, Dorothy was a member of the Notre Dame de Namur congregation. And whoever she was with their acceptance. Whatever she did with their blessing.
It's the relationship, it's the belief, it's the sharing of what you believe together and building slowly together.
You can do anything if your relationship is solid. We really came at it from the sense of us, the Notre Dame group in Brazil. And we tried hard to keep that unity and to keep the reflection and action on what we were doing alive so that we critiqued each other.
What we did was, every evening, we would get together as a team, see what had happened during the day, and then say, where do we go from here? How can we make it better? I mean, it was really good teamwork.
So we really learned from each other. Someone would get an insight that someone else never thought of. And so it was a great way of moving together, respecting our different gifts, but moving together. And I think all of us were the fruit of that togetherness, of that us. In Maranhão, there was a farmer who used to say, it's our usness that's important.
So one day, when Dad announced, all the people are leaving by the busload for the Amazon, and I think I should go with them. The group said,
is this good? Is this important? Can we bless this?
The answer was yes. After all, this is what they were called to do. It went to the very heart of their mission to serve the poor in the most abandoned places. From the moment the nuns arrived in Brazil, they had remained faithful to that mission, accompanying the poor in their struggle for land and a better life. It looked like that struggle might finally be over when, in 1974, the military government called for volunteers to help open the Trans-Amazonian Highway, a road which would cut right through the heart of the vast and virgin Amazon rainforest. In return, each person would be given a little piece of the forest to call his own. It was like a call to the promised land. That's why the poor were headed there the day Dorothy proclaimed her desire to follow, and that's why her fellow sisters gave their blessing. And so, the gung-ho Dorothy Stang, with the more tentative but good-natured Sister Rebecca Spires in tow, followed the people into the forest. But from the beginning, the government's motives were suspect, and the plan was ill-conceived.
In the 1970s, the military government, basically, I think, because of national security, realized they had to get into this Amazon or they were going to lose it, because nobody knew even where the country's frontiers are, where their borders are.
Everyone suspected the poor were really being used to clear a path so the military could go back and forth and so that other bigger businesses could eventually come into the area.
We all suspected that. But anyhow, the call was, if you do this, you will get your promised land, which you've never had.
Land was not all they promised.
They had promised them health and education and houses and everything.
And so the people headed off to the Amazon in droves. And when they arrived,
there was nothing. Absolutely nothing. They're on a dirt road which has a mammoth tropical forest to the very edges of the road. So they can't even see the sun. And they can't see the sky. And they don't see a house. They don't see anything. And really, they probably did not believe that these people were going to stay.
But they did. The first few years were treacherous. The people and the nuns suffered all manner of disease, hepatitis, ungodly worms, deadly malaria. There were no doctors, no hospitals. The nearest town was nearly 100 miles away, and there was no transportation. To get there, they had to walk. In the rainy season, the Trans Am was turned into a thick, muddy mess, and there was no getting in or out. There was no water, no electricity, no store, no schools. Anything they needed, they had to build themselves.
There was a big barn-like structure that they had built temporarily to house the families. And the women and children would stay in this big barn while the men went and built their homes and took down the forest.
The government did keep one promise. Each farmer was given a little plot of land. Each lot was 3 kilometers from the next.
So, you know, in the first lot would be somebody from Ceará, and the next would be somebody from Paraíba, and the next would be somebody from Pernambuco. So they weren't supposed to meet, and they weren't supposed to organize, and they weren't supposed to create any kind of a social structure.
But they did, thanks to Dorothy.
In terms of, you know, like a process, I mean, it really began when Dorothy came.
She planted the seeds of base Christian communities all over again, applying the lessons of liberation theology to this leg of the people's journey, pulling them together, empowering them, knowing when to take the lead and when to step aside.
And so they began to build relationships, and they began to see that they could make something happen here for them.
One of the first actions was to organize the Pioneer Association, which was an organization that functioned as a union, and its principal role was to organize the people in their communities, to have regular meetings, and then to one by one deal with the tough situation.
Food, of course, was at the top of the list. They couldn't grow it fast enough. What little they had, they tried to stockpile.
So they built little deposits of food, and how did they do that? They had no capital. So Dorothy said, but you have a pig, don't you? Yes. Well, let's get the pig pregnant. And if you get the pig pregnant, then you have 8 or 9 or 10 piglets. And so that's what they did. And they began to sell their pigs. And they had money to buy what? Sugar, oil, salt, pepper, you know, the basics. Maybe an onion. And so they would sell these things at cost to themselves. And so this is how they began. And then they would begin to get machines that would husk the rice, that would husk the corn. And so just gradually they build up. Then schools. The government had promised schools. There wasn't a school in sight. So they began to organize and fight for their schools. And many of us would come in the summer, and we would give a course here and there to help with this process. And this is how it happened. So that was the people's process.
And still, they did not expect the people to stay. It's as if they were almost betting on it. Because while the government was ceding small lots of land to the poor subsistence farmers, they were also auctioning off the rights to much larger lots to much wealthier businessmen. These larger lots butted right up to the poor farmers' lots. Now, the poor farmers owned their land. They had earned it. But the land speculators only bought a contract to develop the land, not own it. And there were stipulations.
They were supposed to be industrial-like farms, mostly cattle farms. And they were supposed to, within a certain number of years, fulfill this contract, which was organize the agricultural industry on this land and make it productive. 99% of these people never even came to see their leaning, let alone fulfilled the contract. It was a pure speculative adventure. The contracts were not maintained. So they really had no right to these lands.
At that point, the rights were supposed to transfer back to the government.
But INCRA, the Agrarian Reform Organization of the Government, didn't follow up.
It was a colossally short-sighted and ill-conceived plan. Not only were the development contracts not enforced, there was simply no federal oversight at all. Technically, the land still belonged to the government, but they were totally asleep at the wheel and hundreds of miles away. These were, of course, ideal conditions for the speculators. They weren't going to let a little technicality like legal ownership stop them. They began to buy and sell property that wasn't theirs to begin with, guaranteed with titles and deeds that were completely trumped up.
Those lands passed from one hand to another, documents were invented, were created.
They had money, and money talks. And they could buy their way into any land title company and come out with a document claiming their rights to the land.
In the meantime, the poor subsistence farmers were making a go of it. It was like the great frontier, and there was plenty of land for everyone. As time went by, they sent word for other family members to come join them in the Amazon. People migrated from all over Brazil, and the little farms began to grow.
There was no owner. They saw nobody. It was like the Indians. They just moved in and started living there. And for them, it became theirs. They were land squatters, is what they were. You know, there was nobody to tell them they couldn't.
It was a disaster waiting to happen.
But all of a sudden, after they've been there, somebody appears and says, it's my land.
Hired gunmen, to be exact. Working on behalf of the corrupt land speculators who had no more right to the land than the original contractors.
The problem being that who was saying that it was their land had money, had guns, had power, whereas the poor just had their hard work, their sweat, everything they poured into that lot to help sustain their families. And so then you begin to have conflict. And it just builds.
It was like the Wild West of the 19th century U.S. Think Deadwood, think Tombstone. It was truly the great Brazilian frontier, utterly lawless and miles away from any legal authority.
On that Trans-Amazonian Highway, they're farther away from civilization, farther away from anyone's watchful eye, as it were. So it's easier to pluck you off, and that became an ordinary thing. So if you're in the way of greed or in the way of power, we can pluck you off.
It was deja vu all over again. The wealthy ranchers and loggers and land speculators sent in their hired guns to run the people off the land. Not just the land they laid claim to illegally, but even the people's land for which they had worked so hard. It was a classic tale of good guys and bad guys, the haves and have-nots. The rich were beginning to see the usefulness of this land, and they wanted it. All of it. It was that simple. Money talks, greed takes, the poor get trampled. Then in 1985, the government changed hands. The military dictatorship was out, and democracy was in. That should have been cause for celebration. Instead, for a while, things just went from bad to worse. Out from under the repressive grip of the military police state, some felt free to unleash their own reign of terror.
Because then the landowners began their syndicate. So they locked forces, and they killed. That's what they did. They killed presidents of farmers' unions. They killed them. They thought, we'll get rid of the leadership. I mean, I was with a group who kept tabs on the death rate during those first years of civil government. It was astounding.
The people now had another formidable foe. It wasn't just the aristocrats who felt entitled, or opportunistic businessmen, or incompetent bureaucrats, or corrupt politicians. It was also organized crime. Some people were bought off, some people were scared off. Others just moved deeper and deeper into the forest. Where the people went, Dorothy followed. She kept their hope alive and was relentless in her pursuit of justice for them. Those in power began to take notice, and not in a good way.
There were definitely people who thought she was meddling where she had no business. You know, it's not for a nun to be trying to get the people to have their rights on the land. It's not for a nun to be putting up opposition to anybody.
Dorothy was now on everyone's radar. To those who felt threatened by her, she was a major obstacle and needed to be removed. At first, they tried to set her up, implicating her in all sorts of criminal behavior. One time, she was hauled into the police station on false charges, accused of supplying weapons to the people. This is where it is important to remember certain key things about Dorothy from Part 1. First, she always came prepared. Second, she always had her trusty satchel with her. And third, every moment was a teachable moment. The police got more than they bargained for. Sister Becky Spires.
We weren't allowed to go into where she was, but there was a big window, so we're on the outside looking in, and we can see the police chief is asking her questions and somebody's typing them. So at one point, he pulls out something and shows it to her, and it's a letter supposedly written by her people asking her for weapons. And so Dorothy reaches down into it. She always had a bag full of papers. She had documents for everything. So she pulls out a list of her people's signatures. And she's pointing to him and she says, "Now, I'm sure you have experts in handwriting. So here are the signatures of everybody on our sentiment. Compare them to that and see if you can find." Of course, couldn't. Then he tells the stenographer to stop. He's closing up all his little papers, finished. And Dorothy reaches in and pulls out a big map, spreads it out on the table, and starts teaching him where things are. And he's like, "I want to go home." You can see this on his face. He doesn't want to go into another. But she gives him his lesson.
The funny thing is, as impassioned as she was, as determined as she was, and no matter what dirty tricks were used against her, Dorothy was never tempted to work outside the law.
I mean, to be quite honest, most of the rest of us would just sort of go around the law if it was inconvenient. Not Dorothy.
Dorothy was bound by the law. I would be more civil disobedience. Dorothy worked with the guys. She worked with these government institutions. She believed that they had potential, and she tried to make them work. She tried to make them morally responsible. I mean, she gave her life for them, and they didn't defend her in the end.
Over time, she became quite the expert. She knew how to read and interpret legal codes and knew how to get her hands on written copies. Wherever she went, the routine was the same. She'd walk into any meeting in any government office and politely explain their own laws to them, as was often the case when she visited INCRA, the Agrarian Reform Office. A typical encounter would go something like this.
She pulls out the map and she says, "You know, this is INCRA's map. You, government people, made this map. You're the ones who said this belongs to the people, now respect it. But it's not, I'm right." She said, "You're right." And people would say to her, "You know INCRA is not going to do what they say. They never did. You know the federal police are not going to go." She said, "They have to. That's their job. They said they would." And so she would never give up on believing in, you know, when the rest of us had long since given up on officials. Dorothy did not give up. It was absolutely incredible. I mean, she really believed in the basic goodness of people.
Eventually, she made herself known to any legislator who would listen. She was the best advocate the people had.
I don't think she got to the president, but she got to everybody else.
Her focus was laser-like, and when she was on a mission, she was unstoppable.
There's a story that one of the guys tells. She would always take a farmer with her or two when she would go anyplace. And so one crowd, they went off to Brasilia to meet with the president of INCRA that could help her project. And so they got on the bus. They were on the bus for I don't know how many hours. I mean, it was about 48 to 60 hours of traveling. You know, there are chickens, there are pigs, the people, the children, everybody gets sick. I mean, you get to where you're going in a rather disheveled state, which they did. And she says, "Well, off we're going to go to the ministers." Now, the farmer said, "What? You are going to get a bath and change your clothes." He said to Dorothy, "Because when we go to visit these people, we're going to have to look nice." Dorothy was so intent and so singular that she got off the bus and off they were going to go. And the people would say, "Wait a minute, you know, we may be poor, but we have our pride. And so we're going to, you know, do it our way." And they did.
As the years progressed, Dorothy's focus widened. Up to this point, her main interest had been on securing land for the poor. No one had been very concerned with preserving the precious Amazon rainforest. The poor were as guilty as the rich when it came to tearing it down. In fact, that's what they'd been commissioned to do. But you can't spend years living in the middle of that vast and glorious forest and not fall in love with it. As a child, Dorothy's father had nurtured in her a profound respect for nature. She'd always maintained that respect, but it was rekindled in a new way in the forest. As more and more of the forest disappeared, Dorothy's consciousness was raised, and she realized the future of the people and the forest were inextricably linked.
And that's not an intellectual game. This be for the people, this is to realize that the forest is life, that I'm made up of what the forest is made of. We are, in a sense, brother and sister, and I know that our life depends on it, and its life depends on us. So there's a certain relationship of life established between us that we must respect.
For the farmers, it meant their traditional slash-and-burn farming was out. Sustainable farming was in. It meant paying greater attention to what they planted and where, and leaving part of their lots preserved. Dorothy and the farmers had to relearn everything, reforesting as they went. But reworking their tiny plots of land made little difference. Despite their best efforts, the forest was disappearing all around them. The thing is, the forest was big business for the ranchers and loggers, and they weren't about to change their ways. Within 30 years, 30% of the forest was destroyed. As more and more of the forest disappeared, there was a greater sense of urgency to get the sustainable message out. The fate of the people depended on the fate of the forest.
So the focus, because you don't have a right to use the land unless you give life back to it.
It was another way the nuns could fulfill their mission to proclaim the goodness of God while serving the poor.
It's certainly based in a theology of creation and a theology of the good God, preserving and respecting and living in a harmonious sisterly way with all of nature and all of the people.
For Dorothy, it became her great passion. And so, for her 60th birthday, the congregation sent her on sabbatical to California, where she spent a semester immersed in a course called Creation Spirituality.
She had always loved nature and the earth and the plants and the animals. But after that Creation Spirituality, it took on a much larger portion of her prayer life. Her prayer life was always extremely contemplative and reflective. And one of her favorite saints was Charles de Foucault. And he has a prayer of abandonment. And that was one of her favorite prayers. And that kind of, you create your quiet space wherever you are. You didn't need a church or a special room or you made your space wherever you were. And more the river and the forest became part of the God experience to her as she moved on in life.
After that, saving the forest was all-consuming. She became a one-woman crusader and could often be seen around the village wearing a T-shirt that read, "The death of the forest is the death of the people." She would do anything to help restore it. One day she went to a government agent requesting 400,000 cacao seeds.
So she went to this government agent that we have in town that works with cacao. And so she went to the coordinator of the program. "I need 400,000 seeds for my people, for my PDSs, for my projects." And he said, "Listen, we don't even get 400,000 for the whole municipality. I mean, it's impossible." She says, "But I need them. I have to get them. They have to plant them."
Now, by this point, Dorothy's reputation preceded her, and the agent knew he would not get rid of her that easily. So to appease her, he suggested she write a proposal to the appropriate office requesting the seeds, knowing full well that she wouldn't get them. She didn't skip a beat.
She sat down right that minute, wrote in her handwriting, and sent it off.
The agent was certain it was an exercise in futility. After all, he couldn't get that many for an entire municipality.
She got them. 400,000 seeds of cacao that he said that he couldn't get for the whole municipality, and she managed to do it. Because you can believe she followed up with 100 phone calls.
This is how the days and years went by, celebrating small victories, fighting big battles. A major turning point came when someone in the administration, along with Dorothy, discovered references to sustainable farming in some old INCRA documents. INCRA had planned, at least on paper, for several very large sustainable development projects throughout the Amazon. The idea was to designate certain tracts of land and reserve them for the poor. In turn, the poor would be allowed to farm 20% of it. The other 80% would have to be maintained by the community as forest. It was like a dream come true, one they'd been sitting on all along.
When INCRA comes up with this sustainable development project, well, this is it. You know, like, this could really be an option for the Amazon forest, where it's like a concerted effort of various government agencies as well as private agencies or non-governmental agencies to make sustainable life work for everybody.
Upon closer examination and with further planning, Inkra decided that the area around Anapu, where Dorothy lived, was ideal for two of these projects. This was a major blow to the more powerful ranchers and loggers in the area.
To all of a sudden have a project like this put on them by the government said that over half their lands, 45 lots, 135,000 hectares of forest, the best land, the best forest in the municipality, suddenly is out of their reach. That was a big one for those people to sustain, and they have fought it ever since.
It's hard to know who was tilting at windmills more, the rich ranchers and loggers who were now not only up against Dorothy, but a whole movement, or Dorothy, who was clearly leading the pack.
Some people always said Dorothy was naive. I don't think Dorothy was naive, but I don't think she perceived the extent of the evil she was messing around with. She put her fingers into some pretty deep wounds, and I don't think she realized just how serious it really was and how organized these folks really are. I don't think Dorothy had the vision of how big it was, probably because she didn't concentrate on evil. You know, I mean, some people, when they're going to battle evil, they concentrate on the evil. She battled evil, but she was spreading good, you know, and so her focus was somewhere else.
Once again, the violence escalated. Families and farms were threatened, homes were burned. The unthinkable became thinkable. The community was at a crossroads.
So that's the moment when it became clear to those so-called ranchers that they either had to kill or move out.
They were not about to move out.
You've been listening to Provoke, and part three of our story on modern-day saints and martyrs, and the life and death of Sister Dorothy Stang. Tune in next time for the fourth and final chapter of this tragic but heroic story. In the meantime, if you'd like to listen to or download the first three parts of this story, you can do so at provokeradio.com. That's provokeradio.com. I'm Father Steve Spahn. Tune in again next week and every week. Until then, remember, blessed are the brave of heart, and blessed are the provoked. Provoke is sponsored by the Maryland Province Jesuits.